Welcome to the fourth of a five-part series on King Records, produced for September 2016's King Records Celebration in Cincinnati. During this hour, you'll hear several interviews Brian Powers conducted this summer about the great Henry Glover, whose career at King Records was legendary. You'll hear from his daughter, Sherry Lynn Thompson Scott, music historian Billy Vera, composer Artie Butler, and Seymour Stein, co-founder of Sire Records, as well as vice president of Warner Brothers Records. Plus music from Henry Glover's years at King Records on this special. I'm Lee Hay.
My name is Sherry Lynn Thompson Scott, and I am the living daughter of the late Henry Glover. My father was born on May 21st, 1921, in Hot Springs, Arkansas. And his parents, of course, my grandparents, were John Dixon and Pearl Ware Glover.
What did his father do for a living?
It was exciting. Last summer, I was able to go to the Quapaw Bath and Spa along Bath House Row in Hot Springs. And my grandfather worked as a bath attendant. And my grandmother was a stay-at-home mom.
Did Henry have brothers and sisters?
Yes. He had three total. One died. And then there was an older sister. She was Willie Amanda. And then a younger brother, Nelson. John Dixon Glover. He died in childbirth.
Can you tell us a little bit what you know about his education?
Fortunately, last summer I attended a reunion at Langston High School, and that's where my father graduated in 1939, and I was there with relatives in Hot Springs last summer.
And was he class president?
Yes, he was class president.
So did you learn anything else what he did in high school?
Primarily music. And he played in the band. He played the cornet and also the trumpet.
Did you know how he got exposed to music? Was his family musical? Did they play music around the house? Did you learn any stories about kind of anything like that?
My grandparents were not in favor of him taking up music. They felt that it attracted the wrong kind of people, so they didn't really accept it. In fact, when he went off to one of the bands, my cousin Ware, when we were at a dinner last year, said that he just cried because he went to board a bus with one of the bands, and my grandfather just stood there and cried because he just thought he was making a huge mistake.
Did you know whether Henry's parents, what they thought he should be doing with his career or anything?
Traditionally, all of the family, in fact, many of the cousins, his first cousins, they were in education. And that was kind of the slot everyone went into. And they taught at the college level and at the grade school and high school level. So pretty much that was what everybody kind of expected the Glovers and the Ware children to do.
And he ended up going to college.
Yes, he did. He went to Alabama A&M, and that's in Huntsville.
Any idea what he was going to study when he went there?
He studied band, so he was still on that progression. And, of course, it wasn't accepted, but he did graduate with a bachelor's in education.
He obviously was a composer, so he must have known how to read and write music. Do you think that's where he learned that skill?
Well, I believe that from what I've been told and who shared information with me is that he learned the fundamentals in high school. And there were two music teachers that recognized his talent, and they worked with him quite a bit. And there was a woman, Mrs. Robinson, that he worked with. And then also there was a John Henderson, who was also at the high school. And they, too, worked with him in music and in formulating a band and perfecting the instruments that he played. And Mrs. Robinson even worked with him on doing duets and singing. So they were quite fond of him.
So what did he do after he graduated college in Alabama?
He went directly to Wayne State in Detroit to study band. But during the summers, he had started playing with a number of bands to earn extra money. And through that process, he was making pretty good money and decided not to pursue the graduate degree, and then also came in contact with Mr. Sid Nathan with the King Record Company, who offered him an executive position as an A&R executive in Cincinnati, Ohio.
Right, but in the early 40s, he's playing with several different bands. What instrument was he playing in the band?
Trumpet. And some of the bands that have been noted along the way have been Buddy Johnson and with the Bradshaw. And these are groups that are way before my time, but just in reviewing and going over some of the oral histories, those were some of the bands that he played with.
And I think he might have been an arranger for the Lucky Millinder band.
In fact, he did quite a bit with Lucky Millinder.
I think that's how he eventually met Sid Nathan, was through Lucky Millinder, I believe.
That is correct.
Now, you grew up here in Cincinnati, but I think he lived most of his adult life in New York. What memories did you have when you were a little kid?
Well, he would come to Cincinnati, and he always took us to my mom and when I was younger, and we went to Eden Park, and he'd do all the fun things you can do with a little girl who's 4 or 5 years old. He used to take my older brother along, too, go shopping and going out to eat. And then the other thing, when I think back, it occurred to me that when he wasn't in Cincinnati, he would call. My grandmother lived with us, and I'd be outside playing. I was about 7 or 8, and she'd come to the back door, and she'd say, "Your daddy from New York is on the phone," and I'd run in and talk with him. And as I look back, I always thought that everyone had two daddies, because I was raised by my stepfather, William Thompson, and it was like, I thought there was one in the house, and then there was one who lived in New York. So
I think your mom and your father, didn't they have a connection with music? Didn't they used to play piano together, I think?
They played piano. They listened to piano. He used to take mom to the studio, and she would sit there and observe him with the other musicians. And she said he just had this brilliant way of, now she could talk about observing how he would compose and do a variety of writing, and how he was so in tune when they would do practices that he had an incredible ear. And he would say, "Stop, stop." And he'd say, "Listen, you on the bass, you're off." And he had this natural inclination for music and being able to define it and know when it sounded perfect. And he was a perfectionist with that.
When you were growing up, how aware of his music that he had composed and songs?
All I knew is that he was an impeccably well-dressed, well-spoken gentleman. We knew he must have done something important because he was always in a suit and tie. And he would come to our house, and we had a piano, and he would sit down and play. And then my mom would say, "Well, you know, he works for King," but actually, he never talked much about his recording, and I did not go to the studio like my mom did.
What else would family members talk about Henry's personality?
They said he loved to tell jokes. He was like a life of the party. He enjoyed going fishing, and he had a boat, I understand, in New York, so he would go boating. And I think a lot of things that would help him to relax, but also I found that creative artists, they need different settings in order to spur the creativity. So I'm thinking that perhaps the boating would inspire that. And then he did have his own studio up there in New York. He ran that studio. So he had a lot of time to be creative. And I think that that's why he was able to produce and compose so many songs. And it's known that there were over 1,000 that were composed and written by him.
I mean, he really was probably the most important person at King, because he was not only producing country and R&B sessions, but he's also writing the songs and he's signing the artists. I mean, he really, in the late 40s, early 50s, built that company.
You know?
But after King, he worked for some other labels. But I think you have other songs that he's famous for, like California Sun.
And Peppermint Twist. Right. That was another song that was really popular. And as I've gone through some of the favorite songs that I like now, there's, of course, Fever, Drowning in My Own Tears. Henry's Got Flat Feet, which I also inherited from him. And Blues, Stay Away From Me. But the one song that I believe that he wrote with me in mind, Let the Little Girl Dance, I would perform for him whenever he would come to Cincinnati, of course, in our home.
Well, you told me about California Sun, that you had a theory that he wrote that song because that was sort of a dream he had of going out to the West Coast.
It was. He really did believe that that was the spot to go to. And a lot of the record producers and everything, they were going to California because that's where they were blending the music and the film. And he believed that would be the progression for music. I kind of think a different part of history would have been written had my father had the opportunity to go to California.
Did you reconnect with him when you became an adult?
The last time I actually saw my father is 15 years old. And I think that must have been like about the same time that he had begun his transition away from King. And after that, we would talk. He would send cards or letters. But somehow we became estranged from each other. And that was unfortunate because you never imagine someone's going to pass away before you actually see him again.
When did he pass away? And how did he, do you know what he died from? Or?
He passed away in 1991, and by this time I had different folks, and I also had my half-sister. I learned that he had died suddenly of a massive heart attack at 69, and we were just all kind of in shock.
Did you ever hear what his parents thought about his success in the music business? Any stories on the family? Were they proud? Were they wish he still had gone into education?
I think they were always accepting. Just from what his family has shared, I don't think they totally embraced the whole music world because they felt like it had attracted unsavory folks. And, you know, that wasn't their world.
He did a series of interviews with the Country Hall of Fame near the end of his life, I guess.
1990.
And you've been able to get access to those. I mean, what did you discover for yourself in those interviews?
Well, I tell you, I am indeed grateful for Mr. John Rumble, who is the historian at the Country Music Hall of Fame Foundation. I don't know what sparked that back in 1990. It was an interest that he had composed in that genre of country music. And then, of course, there was a lot of blending. But I think in reading over this, and it's a pretty extensive oral history, I'm just really grateful that we have it because it's always a piece of him with us.
Do you know what become of his copyright stuff? Is that kind of a mess, I would guess?
It's pretty much still a mess. And at this point, I have not made that my focus because I think that there are other areas that need to be addressed. Like, in my mind, there's no reason that he should not be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And I will be working with my relatives and then also those individuals who recognize his contributions to have him posthumously inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And I would also like to see him in the Country Music Hall of Fame. But I think sometimes you have to take it a step at a time. And I've been there and they have a nice exhibit for King Record, and they mention him because Mr. Sid Nathan is already inducted there, and they mention my father, Henry Glover, as being the A&R executive, but he's not been officially inducted.
Hi, I'm Billy Vera. I'm a singer, songwriter, actor, and also a music historian of sorts, done about a couple of hundred reissue CDs and box sets. I won a Grammy for my notes on the Ray Charles box set. And I'm here to talk about the great Henry Glover, a man who I've grown to admire over the years, the more I study his work.
Can you give us a little background about how he started as a professional musician, what bands he was playing with, and what time period this would have been?
Well, yeah. After college, where he graduated with a bandmaster's degree, he started working with various bands around as a trumpet player. And in 1944, he was playing first trumpet with the great Buddy Johnson Band, and he played on the session that came up with a couple of hits for Buddy. That's the Stuff You Gotta Watch, and Fine Brown Frame, and the debut of Buddy's vocalist Arthur Prysock, who had a hit with a song called They All Say I'm the Biggest Fool. And then over the next few years, Henry went into a number of other bands. He recorded in 1946 with Willie Bryant for Apollo Records. A song of Henry's called Sneaky Pete, which was later recorded by Bull Moose Jackson. And then in 1947, Glover recorded with Tiny Bradshaw and his band for Savoy Records, and also did some arranging for Paul Gayton's band. And in 1945, he joined Lucky Millinder's band.
Can you tell us how Henry Glover met Sid Nathan, the owner of King Records?
Sure. When Henry was with the Lucky Millinder band, they did a date in Cincinnati. Lucky was under contract to Decca Records at that time. And Nathan had already made some headway with his new company, King Records, in the country field. And he wanted to branch out. His feeling was, well, I have my promotion men and my salesmen go down to all these little towns in the South, and why not go to the other side of the tracks and sell music to black people as well? Sid Nathan was a visionary in my mind. He did a lot of things before other label bosses did. And so he heard Lucky's band and thought they were just great and saw the audience reaction to them. But he couldn't sign the Millinder band, so Lucky recommended, from what I hear, that he talk to Henry, because Henry was a very sharp guy and he was doing arrangements for the band. And so Nathan took him on as an A&R guy.
He started writing a lot of songs for King Records, and some of them were hits.
Yeah, he had, if you look at Henry Glover up on BMI.com, you see the little stars next to a bunch of his songs, which mean that they were BMI award winners. And some of the early hits were by Bull Moose Jackson, who was a sax player and a singer in the Millinder band. And on his own, he had hits with Glover songs like I Love You, Yes I Do, All My Love Belongs to You, which was later recorded on King by a young Steve Lawrence in another version. And then Little Girl Don't Cry was also recorded by Bull Moose on King. And then Benny Goodman covered that band with a young Buddy Greco on Capitol Records.
So Sid hires Henry to be an A&R man. Can you explain what an A&R man is?
An A&R man means artist and repertoire. An A&R guy is the guy who marries the song to the artist and then goes in and what we would call today a producer, record producer. He oversees, supervises the session, picks the songs, matches it with the artist, chooses the best musicians for that particular song and that particular artist and the best arranger. So it's an overall supervisor, basically, of recording. Glover not only produced records by a number of Lucky Millinder's sidemen and vocalists, including Anastine Allen and later Henry's childhood friend Big John Greer, another saxophonist. But he also did country records as well. You know, he went down to Nashville and produced people like Cowboy Copas, who had the original cover of Tennessee Waltz. There's a funny story. Nathan would send Cowboy Copas to Nashville to find songs, but he would caution him, never pay more than $35 for a song. And I can kind of do an impression of Nathan's voice. So one time he sent Cowboy down to Nashville and he brought back songs. He said, "Well, Mr. Nathan," he said, "I brought you back some good songs," he said, "but there was one great one that I had to pass up because the guy wanted $50 for it." And Nathan says, "You done good, Cowboy. Ain't no song in the world worth $50. Well, that song happened to be Tennessee Waltz, which made probably a few million dollars over the years. So sometimes he was penny wise and pound foolish.
Wasn't Henry writing some country songs for King and co-writing with some of those King records artists, country artists?
Yes, he did. For Wayne Rainey, he wrote "Why Don't You Haul Off and Love Me," which was covered by Bull Moose Jackson on King. That was one of Sid Nathan's visionary moves. He figured a good song is one that can be performed in numerous versions and in numerous idioms. So he would very often take a country song and record it by one of his rhythm and blues artists, or take a rhythm and blues song and have his country artist cover it as well. And in some cases, he even had Glover do pop versions of songs, as in the Steve Lawrence version of "All My Love Belongs to You." So he figured the best way to make money on songs that he published would be to exploit them. And another thing that Nathan did was he'd give his A&R men their own publishing companies, co-owned by King Records, of course. And the one that Glover had was called J&C Music. And so Henry ended up owning half publishing on a number of big songs over the years, thanks to the wisdom of his boss, Sid Nathan. Another country song that was big was "Bloodshot Eyes" by Hank Penny. Moon Mullican had one called "Cherokee Boogie," which was covered by Bull Moose Jackson. And of course, the Delmore Brothers' "Blues Stay Away From Me," which was a very interesting song. And I think Glover's contribution to that was he had the musicians play a similar background to a current hit of the day called "The Hucklebuck." So we hear "Taste of the Hucklebuck" on this country record, which really was the combining of rhythm and blues and country music was one of the main formulae for the creation of what would later be known as rock and roll.
Yeah, so I guess Henry was overseeing a lot of that. He was writing the songs and overseeing these sessions, both country and R&B.
And he also, like many people in the business at that time, he would buy a song from a writer. So no human could write as many songs as are attributed to Henry Glover. But he admitted to, yeah, sometimes a guy would come to me with a song and I'd, you know, give him $25, $35, $50 for it. So there's really no telling which ones he wrote and which ones he didn't.
Well, he's doing all this in the late 40s. Were there any other African Americans in that role in the record industry at that time?
Oh, yeah. I mean, going back to the 20s, there was J. Mayo Williams, who worked for Decca Records. He produced the first Louis Jordan records, and then he had his own label. There was Paul Gayton, who worked for Regal Records, as well as was a recording artist on that label. So there were a number of black A&R men at the time. Henry was certainly one of the most successful.
In addition to doing country and the jump blues, he also were working with some of the vocal groups, wasn't he? Like the Swallows, I think. Didn't he work with them?
Well, later, yeah. In the early 50s, after the success of the Orioles and the Ravens and some other groups, King Records got into the vocal group situation. Not quite as successfully as some other labels, but he certainly made some wonderful records. The Swallows was one of my favorites. They had two lead singers, one of whom was a guy named Junior Denby, who was almost a carbon copy of Charles Brown, who was a gigantic rhythm and blues star in the 40s. So they had a big hit record called Beside You. Their other records are equally as good, but they just didn't sell quite as well.
It ain't the meat, it's the motion. Makes your daddy wanna rock. It ain't the meat, it's the motion. It's the movement that gives it the sock. Now I had a girl so doggone thin, no meat, no bones, she was just all skin. One thing about her I can understand, she wraps all around me like a rubber band. It ain't the meat, it's the motion. Makes your daddy wanna rock. It ain't the meat, it's the motion. It's the movement that gives it the sock.
And then there was another group that was on King that Glover discovered. They were from Brooklyn, called The Strangers. And they made about five records that all flopped commercially. But to me, they were just an amazing group. Their old records became very popular in the early 60s in New York among record collectors. Songs like My Friends and Hoping You'll Understand. And I think the thing that set The Strangers apart was that they, like the Rolling Stones, who they sound nothing like, but they reached beyond their own capabilities. In other words, like the Rolling Stones wanted to be Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf, but couldn't really do it, and thereby found their own sound, which was made them successful. The Strangers wanted to be a modern harmony jazz group. They didn't really have qualifications for that, since they were somewhat a little more primitive, but by reaching so high musically and not achieving what they were reaching for, they ended up having a sound that was all their own.
It seems by the early 50s, King had Henry Glover based in New York. I know he would still come to Cincinnati and do sessions, but he was kind of in charge of the New York branch. Besides the vocal groups, who else was he recording out of New York?
Well, I think if you look in the King master book, you will see the personnel on the sessions, and that will tell you pretty much where the sessions were done. You see a lot of New York musicians on there, many of whom came out of Lucky Millinder's band, some of whom came out of the Erskine Hawkins band, and other guys that were just your New York session players, like Sam the Man Taylor, like Mickey Baker, Panama Francis on drums, and some good jazz musicians that were out of New York. So that's your clue as to where the sessions were recorded. I think Henry liked living in New York. So he had that office on, I think the office was on 54th Street, and he shared it with Andy Gibson, who was another arranger, very good arranger, who wrote The Hucklebuck, among other things. And Little Willie John, who was a quite successful artist for King Records, he was recorded in New York. His first hit was a song called All Around the World, later known as Grits Ain't Groceries. And of course, Henry brought him a song that he did not like very much. But, you know, Henry managed to sweet talk him into recording it, a little thing called Fever. And that became a big hit for Willie, probably his biggest hit of all time. And then, of course, it became a standard a couple years later when it was revived by Peggy Lee.
Get a feeling that's so hard to bear. You give me fever when you kiss me, fever when you hold me tight, fever in the morning, fever all through the night. Listen to me, baby, hear every word I say. No one can love you through me fever. When you kiss me, fever, when you hold me tight. Fever in the morning and fever all through the night. Bless my soul, I love you. Take this heart away. Take these arms I'll never use. And just believe in what my lips have to say. You kill me fever. When you kiss me, fever, when you hold me tight. Fever in the morning and fever all through the night. Sun lights up the daytime, moon lights up the night. My eyes light up when you call my name, cause I know you're gonna treat me right. You give me fever. When you kiss me, fever, when you hold me tight. Fever in the morning and fever all through the night.
And then Little Willie John had other hits. Talk to Me was one, and another one was Let Them Talk, which were two quite famous records. So he was with King Records for quite a while, too. One of the things about King Records was that because they had their own plant where they could do everything from recording to pressing to printing up the record sleeves, to printing up the labels, to printing up the quite ugly LP jackets. That was the one thing I never understood, why they used such cheesy-looking album covers. But they did everything there, you know. Nathan also had an innovative idea. He bought a bunch of bread trucks when a bakery went out of business, and he had them refitted with shelving, so that he could have what served as a rolling distribution point. He could have his drivers just drive around the South with truckloads of records rather than mailing them.
I wanted to talk about a singer named Lulu Reed. Can you talk about her and some of the songs that Henry worked with her?
Lulu Reed was a gospel singer who joined the band of Sonny Thompson, which was a popular band in the Midwest. Lulu was from Ohio, northern Ohio, and the first record she made with Sonny Thompson became a hit called I'll Drown in My Tears. And the song, of course, went on to become a standard under the name Drown in My Own Tears after it was recorded a few years later by Ray Charles. Lulu had a couple more hits, and she was a terrific singer. Watchdog was a big hit for her, a song that Glover wrote. He also wrote Drown in My Own Tears, by the way, which has gone on to become a standard, as I said. Watchdog was covered by a lot of people at the time, both in the rhythm and blues and rock and roll and pop fields. So she went on for quite a while to have a nice little career. She married Sonny Thompson eventually, and then she got religion and left the business. Her last recordings, to my knowledge, were for Ray Charles's Tangerine label. I think he did two sessions with her, put out about three or four records.
It brings a tear into my eyes when I begin to realize I cry so much.
I understand Henry Glover produced Roland Kirk's, his first album for King.
I don't know if it was an album. I have a photo from King Records with Roland Kirk. He also did Eddie Lockjaw Davis and Leo Parker, the baritone sax player, but he didn't quite have the success in jazz that he had in rhythm and blues and country music. And I've tried to figure out why, because he certainly had an ear for who was good, but I think he was trying to make, and this might have been on his marching orders from Sid, trying to make jukebox records. And the era of the LP was coming in jazz. And so whereas Blue Note Records or even Prestige, which did what we call blowing sessions, which are without rehearsal, basically, those kind of records were grabbing the ears of the album buyer, whereas the jazz that King put out did not. He was trying to make the statements within a 3-minute period for the jukeboxes. And I think that was the failure of the jazz department.
I think a really big hit for King, Henry Glover had a part of, was Honky Tonk by Bill Doggett in 56.
Honky Tonk, personally, was the first record I ever bought. I was 12 years old at the time. I spoke to Billy Butler, who was the guitar player on that record, about it. And he said basically it was a jam session. They were just jamming and they put it out and they caught a groove. And that groove caught the ear of the nation and the world. It was a gigantic record, one of the biggest records King ever had. Every bar band in the world had to learn that song verbatim. Sign Lucky Millinder after in 1951 after his RCA Victor brief soiree was over, and the first hit that Lucky Millinder Band had on King, co-written by Glover, was a song called "I'm Waiting Just for You." The lyric was written by Carolyn Lee, who would go on to write a lot of standards with Cy Coleman. She also wrote the lyrics for the Frank Sinatra hit Young at Heart. But I'm Waiting Just for You was her first hit that she co-wrote with Glover. Glover wrote the music. And the vocalist on I'm Waiting Just for You was Ernestine Allen and a fellow named John Carroll, who was a member of Lucky's band.
You had to leave me all by myself, dear, and I've been crying the whole night through. But I've been telling everybody I'm waiting just for you. Your friends are trying so hard to tempt me. There's no use trying, 'cause I'll be true. And darling, you don't have to worry, nobody else will do.
And then they signed a couple of writers, Charlie Singleton, who went on to write many, many hits. In later years, he's co-writer on Strangers in the Night. And Teddy McRae, who was a musician in the Jimmy Lunsford band. And together they wrote a couple of hits for King, Person to Person for Eddie Cleanhead Vincent, which they recycled later for Little Willie John, and a song called All Night Long, Bill Moose Jackson did first, and then went on to be a much-covered song, including by Keeley Smith in later years. Glover signed Jimmy Rushing, the former blues singer of the Count Basie band. He had Joe Thomas, a great sax player with Jimmy Lunsford, a big hit called Page Boy Shuffle. He signed Champion Jack Dupree, the blues man, and they had a bunch of hits, Tongue Tied Blues and a bunch of other things. And he made the first records with Joe Tex. None of them were hits, unfortunately, but he did okay with him. And then in 1959, he brought back Hank Ballard and the Midnighters. They had briefly left the label. They had recorded as the Midnighters for Federal, a subsidiary of King. Another A&R man, Ralph Bass, had done most of their sessions, although Henry did a couple of them. Work with Me Annie was a big one by the Midnighters. But by this time, Hank Ballard needed a hit. So Henry wrote a song called Teardrops on Your Letter for the group. And then for a B-side, he did a song that Hank Ballard wrote and Henry published in his J&C Music, a little thing called The Twist. And Teardrops on Your Letter became a hit, and then The Twist started making some noise as well. And Hank was unable to make an appearance on American Bandstand, so Dick Clark, being the enterprising fellow that he always was, alerted some Philadelphia friends of his who owned Cameo Parkway Records. And they had a young singer named Chubby Checker. And Chubby and Cameo Parkway did a note-for-note copy of Hank Ballard's version of The Twist with a little more of an eighth-note feel rather than the more of a shuffle feel that Hank did. And, of course, it not only became a number one pop record, but it became an iconic record and dance, a phenomenon of the early 60s, the pre-British invasion 60s. And The Twist, of course, will figure a little bit later in Henry Glover's career.
Okay, my name is Artie Butler, and I'm an arranger, songwriter, composer. And I met Henry Glover, actually, when I was 14 years old, somewhere thereabout. And I'm now, I'll be 74 in December, so I met him at a private school in New York in Manhattan called the Rhodes School. And one day, it was on 11 West 54th Street, and one day I, instead of going to the lunchroom, left the building, made a right turn. The school was located right off 5th Avenue, so I made a right turn. I just started wandering, and I got to almost 8th Avenue, and then I saw this brownstone building with all these albums in the window. And they were albums of artists that I had started listening to when I was 12 and a half years old. James Brown, Etta James, Etta Jones, the Ink Spots, Bill Doggett, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I was just attracted to the window, and I walked up into the brownstone. And I don't know where I got my guts from, but I just walked up, and this lady named Shirley stopped me at the office and said, "Can I help you?" And I said, "My name is Artie Butler, and I'm just passing through. I'd like to audition for King Records as a singer." And she looked at me, and she understood that there was this precocious young kid. And she said, "Well, just a minute, let me get my boss." And about a minute later, this young man stuck his head out, and he said, "Yes, can I help you?" And I went through the whole spiel again. And he said, "Well, come on in." And then he says, "My name is Henry Glover." And it was an office that was just like in all the old movies that you see. There was a desk, there was a piano, there was a typewriter. Of course, there was no computer. And there were some pictures on a wall, some sheet music on a wall. And on his desk was a photo of Ray Charles, autographed to him. He says, "Well, what would you like to do?" I said, "I'd like to sing for you. I'm a singer." And he said, "Well, go ahead." He says, he asked me if I had any arrangements with me. I, of course, said no. I never sang before in my life. I don't know what in the world I was doing there. And he said, "What would you like to do?" I said, "I'd like to sing Shaboom," which was a big hit record at the time, and I sang it a cappella. And he said, "I like the way you sing." He said, "Would you like to sing something else?" I said, "Sure." And I sang, I forgot what the heck the other song was. Anyway, he stopped me before I finished it, and he said, "Sit down, Artie." He said, "I like your voice, I like your style, and I'm going to sign you to Deluxe Records." And it was my first entree to Henry Glover. And I made a record for Deluxe Records, which, of course, never came out. I mean, it never was a hit that came out. Many years later, I started working in the recording industry at Bell Sound Studios, and Henry Glover was in and out of there all the time, and we became buddies. And he was the warmest, sweetest, funniest guy ever. And he was recording Dinah Washington, and he was recording all kinds of artists for Morris Levy, for Roulette.
Oh, baby, don't you know? Yes, baby, I love you so. Gee, baby, you made me go lock, stock, and barrel of you. Yes, baby, things look fine with you on my party line. Gee, baby, all the time, lock, stock, and barrel of you. It's been a long, long time without you. Now that you're finally here, what you know, dear, I can't let you go, dear. Watch your follow it near. Sweet baby, you're for me. It's very plain to say. I'm your eternally locked, stock, and barrel of you.
This is Seymour Stein, chairman of Sire Records, and vice president of Warner Brothers Records. I've had many mentors over the years, but first and foremost was Sid Nathan, the founder and head of King Records. Thanks to him, I really learned the nuts and bolts of the music business. Also thanks to him, I met some really great people, among them Henry Glover, but also people that Henry was very close to, like Andy Gibson, the writer of The Hucklebuck, among other songs, and Rudy Toombs, who wrote all these great songs about whiskey, even though he was a teetotaler. Songs like One Mint Julep and One Scotch, One Bourbon, One Beer, Let Me Go Home Whiskey, Bad, Bad Whiskey. I never saw him touch a drop. And Henry was very close with both those people. And I believe I first met Henry either in Cincinnati or at the King offices in New York when he was visiting with Rudy Toombs.
Sid hired Henry Glover as an A&R man back in the late 40s. I was wondering, can you maybe talk about Sid Nathan, him hiring Henry, who was an African-American at that time? I mean, you knew Sid. Can you maybe comment about?
Look, first of all, King Records was a company that specialized in rhythm and blues and country music, both. Cincinnati being a border town like Baltimore, you know, had lots of African-American people there and some very, very talented ones. King Records grew from country and rhythm and blues music to being many years the number one independent label, you know, according to Billboard. And I think that more than anyone else, above and beyond Sid, I think Henry Glover really played a leading role. And there were a lot of great people there, but I think that I would certainly give Henry credit for being the most valuable player next to Sid. Now, of course, in 1947, I was 5 years old, so I didn't experience this firsthand. I met him about, I'd say, 10 years later when I was about 15 years old and working part-time at Billboard. And he would come into the King offices. I don't know if he was still working for King at that time. I don't know. But he was certainly on a very friendly basis with Rudy Toombs and others. And I guess with Sid as well. Sid always sung his praises.
One of the things I think we wanted to talk about was Henry overseeing country music sessions.
I think that in the same way that I felt that Ivory Joe Hunter, who had nothing to, well, who did record for King, but was sort of like a missing link between country music and rhythm and blues, because so many of the songs that he wrote and some of them that he recorded, like Since I Met You Baby and stuff like that, were hits in country and in rhythm and blues. But Henry wrote Blues Stay Away From Me, which was originally a hit for the Delmore Brothers, but also recorded in country by Ray Price and in R&B by B.B. King. And there's also a Doc Watson version of it as well. Henry had a hand in writing I'll Sail My Ship Alone, which was a big hit on King by Moon Mullican. Henry also wrote I'm Waiting Just For You, which was done by Lucky Millinder on King, R&B, and by Hawkshaw Hawkins as country on King. It was also a pop hit for Pat Boone, and a rockabilly recording was done by Wanda Jackson, you know, I guess more of a country version by Wanda Jackson. So I think that Henry understood the closeness between country and R&B. I don't know if he learned this during his years at King or he knew this before, but he definitely was someone who understood that a great song in country could be a great song in the rhythm and blues field, in the same way that Sid Nathan understood that as well.
And you told me a story about at Sid's funeral that you talked to Henry.
Oh, yes. We were all pallbearers there, and it just was kind of, you know, seeing Ben Barth there, James's manager, and his brother-in-law, who was Sid Nathan's lawyer, Jack Pearl. And we kind of, you know, joked a little bit about that, but it was very solemn for me. I mean, Sid was like a second father to me, and as I said before, a great mentor. I saw Henry, of course, many times after that, and when I learned of his passing, I was very upset. Just coincidentally, I'm trying very hard to get him the recognition he deserves by being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which has not yet happened. If you look at what the two main ingredients were that started rock and roll, it was country music and it was rhythm and blues. I mean, Elvis Presley's first six records, the ones that he made for Sun, only hit the country chart. It wasn't until he moved over to RCA and put out Heartbreak Hotel that he started to really get attention in the pop field. And these were the two main elements, rhythm and blues and country. There were other things, of course, but Henry was so adept at crossing into both of those categories.
And having hits, too.
Oh, well, yes. Well, if he didn't have hits, we wouldn't know about him. He was a brilliant man. Look, if I had to say who I thought was the second most important person at King Records in terms of overall, you know, hits and things, it definitely would be Henry Glover. You don't think it was one of those executives that he had there. They knew nothing about music. It was Sid and Henry. They were like a team.
So why do you think he should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
Why? Because he was a bridge. First of all, because of what he accomplished, but also that he was a bridge between country and rhythm and blues, which were the main original components of what later became known as rock and roll.
You've been listening to a King Records special about Henry Glover at King Records. For more information on September's celebration of King Records in Cincinnati, please visit our website, wvxu.org. Technical support from Andy Balterman. Next week, join us for a special about Henry Glover's career after King Records. I'm Lee Hay.